I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
I think that if we were really covering politics in a way that framed the stakes appropriately, you wouldn't even talk to someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz, these people who are proven liars and, you know, are very, they're concerned about kind of themselves first and foremost, and, you know, policy or how that's affecting their constituents kind of comes second, if at all.
Hi, friends. I've been thinking a lot about the news. There's TV news, cable news, mainstream print media, and independent journalists. I'm not going to go into the right-wing rage machine, but I do want to talk about the mainstream media and its coverage of American politics. The question is, what is the media's responsibility to truth, to democracy, to fairness, to accuracy? As we've been discussing since this pod has started, MAGA's goals and tactics are different than a normal political party. Its goals are to wage war on democracy, wage war on Americans, and to generally destroy the system. That's what January 6th was all about, and that's what all the extreme and harmful laws MAGA-captured states are passing. But the media seems incapable of understanding that the MAGA GOP is not a normal political party the way we understand it in America. So they cover national politics as business as usual, chewing on poll after poll, opining on which GOP presidential primary candidate has a chance to beat Trump, treating Trump as a normal presidential candidate. They treat each party as generally different sides of the same coin. But we know they're not. We know that if Trump is elected, he plans to defeat democracy as well. We know that other MAGA Republicans are different flavors of fascists, but fascists nonetheless. The two sides are not, in fact, the same. The parties are asymmetrical, with the Democrats concerned with governing and making people's lives better, and the Republicans concerned with blowing up the system. The fights over the debt ceiling and the government shutdown and the Speaker of the House have shown us that. So, what is the correct role of journalism? Jay Rosen, who's a journalism professor at NYU, says, and I'm completely with him on this, that the job of journalism is to report the truth instead of presenting both sides of an issue. It's the journalist's responsibility, in fact, to stop talking about the odds, what the Trump-Biden race looks like 1 year out or any other poll, and start talking about the stakes. What does it mean for America if Trump were to win? What does it mean for America that the GOP can't even choose a speaker? Talking about Biden's age is ludicrous when Trump is only 3 years younger and obviously batshit. We'll be talking about this more as time goes on and we get closer to the 2024 election. I want to keep it in mind as we think about what happens in the 2023 elections and how the results are covered. When journalists become independent and set up their own shops, they can call out the truth without needing the approval of their corporate overlords. My guest, Aaron Rupar, did exactly that, and his newsletter, Public Notice, produces some of the best reporting and analysis of our current moment. Several other reporters contribute, and in my opinion, it's worth the subscription. The newsletter says this about its identity, quote, "It's fair, but not impartial. We think democracy and fair elections are good things, and unlike a lot of mainstream coverage, are not shy about saying so," end quote. Aaron Rupar spent 3 years at Vox and became one of the foremost chroniclers of Trumpism, explaining what's happening on the American right for a largely progressive audience. We'll talk about his decision to go independent, along with a lot of other issues in journalism today. Before we start our interview, I want to remind you that you can get early access to podcasts, bonus content, and backstage glimpses by becoming a patron and helping me feed my family. www.patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Now for our conversation. Welcome, Aaron Rupar. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Over Fascism.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to join you.
I'm so excited that you are with us. I have been reading your Substack for a long time. And in fact, this morning you published about journalists and how they're covering Trump. And I've been wanting to talk about the role of journalism and our democracy for a really long time. So this is really timely. In the mainstream media, you see a lot of, you know, polling and a horse race and how is Biden doing relative to Trump, and knowing what we know about 2022 and what the poll said, and knowing what we know about the stakes, it seems a little bit, from my perspective, as a historian, B, an activist, odd that journalists are really making so much of a horse race of this, as if Republicans and Democrats right now are symmetrical.
You know, I was listening to Jay Rosen, the NYU journalism professor, and his formulation has been really on my mind, which is that we need to be covering not the odds, but the stakes of what's happening.
What's your view of journalism in the United States? What do you think journalists should be doing? How do you look at the whole journalism politics conversation?
Yeah, I agree with Jay's point in that respect. And, you know, my newsletter today featured an interview with Lawrence Glickman, who is a professor at Cornell. And I ended up reaching out to him to do a Q&A because he posted a thread on the heels of Trump's recent visit to Michigan. And this ended up kind of encapsulating, I think, some of the problems that, you know, elite journalists are having, because, you know, this is already kind of feels like ancient history because it was a couple of weeks ago and a lot has happened since then. But Trump went to Michigan and his campaign told the press that he was going there to speak to unionized United Auto Workers, unionized workers, and kind of make a pitch to them on his labor policy. And what ended up actually happening was that Trump was invited to speak at a non-union shop by management. And yet, you know, despite the fact that it wasn't clear at all if Trump had met with a single unionized worker during this trip, the New York Times, most egregiously, and to a lesser extent, the Washington Post, ran with framing of stories about Trump's trip where they basically said Trump meets with unionized auto workers and, you know, makes a pitch to organize labor. And, you know, I think it really encapsulated kind of how the, you know, either the press gets lazy or kind of chase optics instead of the substance of what's actually happening. And so in my mind, it did kind of bring back memories of some of the really egregious coverage from 2016. It was a little bit disconcerting in that respect in terms of what lessons have been learned. Now, New York Times, in the days after a lot of their coverage got a lot of criticism, walked some of it back, added a correction to their main article about Trump's trip, mentioning that he was at a non-union shop and all the evidence indicates that he only met with non-union workers. So at least eventually they attempted to get that part of the story right. But, you know, I think that was one little episode that kind of touches upon some broader concerns. I will say that I think the press got better in 2020 at calling Trump out. You know, if you remember, all through the summer and fall of that year, Trump was telegraphing that he was going to use lies about mail voting to try to undermine the election results. And, you know, there was a lot of reporting and commentary based on Trump's statements, you know, everything that he was saying, both at news conferences, on social media, things like that, that the strategy was basically to declare victory on election night before all of the mail votes had a chance to be counted, and use that to try and stay in power, even if he ended up losing. And of course, we have to remember that that was during peak COVID, where there were a lot of people, you know, legitimately concerned about going to polling places and voting. And so there was much more demand for mail voting than there would have been in a normal cycle. And I remember thinking, you know, and writing about that at Vox at the time, that the press was really getting better at calling Trump out and kind of saying that, hey, he's lying about this. We can think back on a lot of his statements about COVID at the time and how the press got more aggressive with fact-checking him. And so I did feel like, you know, over the course of his 4 years in office, and I think, you know, reporters, editors being mindful of 2016 got better. And I'm not sure if it's, you know, a deal now or 4 years later where, you know, the press is kind of out of practice. I do think we've seen over the past, you know, 2-3 years since Biden has been in office, kind of this reflexive tendency to frame stories around how it's bad for Biden, or this, you know, kind of notion, I think, that the press says that part of their job is to be adversarial toward those who are in power, which is true to a point. And so, you know, we get kind of this reflexive framing of, you know, even when job reports are good, as the one was for September that came out a week ago today, you know, there was an image that was circulating on X, or, you know, formerly Twitter, that I saw getting a lot of traction, of the New York Times' homepage about the jobs report, because every story they had 4 or 5 stories, and every single one of them was framed around here's why this good jobs report is bad news for you, is bad news for Biden. And so there is that tendency that I think, you know, probably any president would experience. But when the alternative to Biden at this point is Donald Trump, who is, you know, telegraphing that he's going to, if he returns to power, try and finish off American democracy once and for all, you would hope that the press could do a better job kind of framing the stakes of that, as you mentioned, you know, with what Jay Rosen has been saying. And so I think there is a lot to that. And I think, you know, oftentimes from outlets like The Times and The Washington Post, we don't see enough emphasis on the stakes, and we see too much horse race or too much, you know, kind of this prism of how everything is bad for Biden. And, you know, a lot of fixation on polling, which, you know, at this stage in the game is significant, but I don't think it's determinative. I hope that as we get closer and closer to November of next year, that some of those lessons from 2020 kind of emerge, you know, in some of the coverage that we read. But, you know, again, I thought this episode surrounding Trump's recent trip to Michigan was disconcerting because it does indicate that there's still fixation on the horse race and on optics, and you're kind of missing the bigger story when you focus on those things.
And also beyond Trump, I found the coverage around, say, the Republican debate to be almost pointless because Trump wasn't there. He's probably going to be the nominee, and yet treating it as though it were a serious exercise in figuring out who the next nominee is going to be, rather than saying, however they wanted to say it, Trump's likely to be the nominee, this is a sideshow, or they all are, you know, let's look at what they're saying and how it reflects our democracy or doesn't. How do you see that?
I mean,
beyond the bigger picture, the beyond Trump picture.
Yeah, I think the debates are kind of a tricky one right now because, you know, if we go back to the 2016 cycle, I remember the first couple Republican debates of that cycle were like huge news events. I mean, I remember going to a bar that, you know, just like a normal bar in Minneapolis that had a projector screen and they had the debate on. They were these huge spectacle news events that people who normally don't care about politics, you know, paid attention to and watched. And then even the 2020 cycle, the Democratic debates were big news events because it was unclear who the nominee was going to be. And so I just think it's kind of like a reflex that the news media has or the political media has to cover these debates like they're big spectacles, even though they're pretty sad this time around for all the reasons that you kind of touched upon, where, you know, Trump is quite clearly going to be the nominee. So what's even the point of having a bunch of these candidates where you add up all the support they have collectively and it probably doesn't even amount to, you know, it's probably barely 30%. I just think if you are, you know, working in a major newsroom, you're programmed to believe that these debates are big news events. And I kind of fall into that too. I mean, I've watched both debates and live tweeted them and then written about them for my newsletter. But you're right that, you know, when you take a step back, they don't really mean anything. And, you know, the polling, you know, the analysis of polling that's been done with the trend line through these debates has shown that it hasn't really affected anything. It's a weird situation right now because I think there is kind of a belief, you know, people have to keep the possibility in mind that Trump's legal problems could get to a point where he is in so much legal trouble that that could affect his candidacy or he might drop out or something like that. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think if this was a normal situation where Trump was a normal candidate and he was so far ahead of the competition, it'd be kind of a farce to take these debates seriously. But there's so much that's going to happen over the next year that we can't predict. And so you kind of have to pay attention to who these other people who could step into that role might be. But you're right. I think one thing that the debates do make clear that I think is significant is the extent to which policy has kind of become very secondary for Republicans. Now, of course, they're talking about very draconian abortion bans. They're talking about very draconian immigration policies. And so we shouldn't dismiss that, or we shouldn't downplay the extent to which the Republican candidates do have a policy agenda and that it is quite harmful. But, you know, it really has become kind of a cult of personality. And because none of them are really willing to take on Trump, and I think the way that you would have to defeat him, which would be kind of highlighting his legal problems, making a case that he's a loser based on 2020, that he, you know, he's not a good matchup with Biden, he's already lost to him. You know, they're afraid to say those things, with maybe the exception of like a Chris Christie, who doesn't really have traction. But because they're not willing to make those arguments, they are kind of, you know, it's almost like a sideshow.
But what I would hope to see is more of a focus on what do these draconian policies. Okay, so even if we think that not one of those secondary Republicans, tertiary Republicans, has a chance of winning the nomination. They're still advocating for really, really draconian anti-democratic policies, a lot of which have already been enacted in a lot of the red states. What is your thought about the way that the national media is really covering the places where a lot of those policies have been enacted and what the effects of those have been? As opposed to the horse race, but also seeing presidential politics as some way completely different from what's going on in the states, which is where a lot of the policies that the presidential candidates are, they're already being tried out. And we already see effects.
I think it's hard to paint with too broad of a brush because, for instance, I think back on when Roe was overturned last summer, there were a bunch of stories in the months that followed about pregnant people in states that enacted bans and like some really heart-wrenching stories about, you know, mothers who their child had some sort of horrible health problem, but then because abortion wasn't legal in those states anymore, they had to carry these pregnancies to term or carry them to a point where their own health was in danger. And, you know, then that brought up all these questions surrounding doctors. And, you know, doctors don't want to be prosecuted for murder or for some, you know, terrible crime because they're administering reproductive health care to a pregnant person. But, you know, so the point simply being, I do think that stories like that, which are obviously very important in the context of what's happening on the ground in these states that are restricting rights, they do get some coverage. Now, you know, the debates that we were just talking about are kind of unique situations in that the first one was on Fox News, the second one was on Fox Business, and obviously those are both right-wing Trump propaganda outlets. And so I don't really expect them to, you know, adopt a framing of like, here's how these policies are hurting people because they support those policies. You know, we'll see if future debates are on more of kind of a, you know, credible network, you know, if there are questions like that that come up, because I do think those are important ones for Republicans to grapple with. And you're not going to get that necessarily if you're on Newsmax or Fox News or Fox Business. But yeah, I mean, I think broadly you're right. I think it, you know, it again, as you kind of touched upon, it depends if you're reading local coverage, because that was one of the things I touched upon today. And this is slightly in a different, my newsletter today was not talking about restricting rights or, you know, like abortion bans that are really hurting people. It was talking about kind of the silly trip that Trump made to Michigan to counter program the second debate. But one thing that did come through is that a local reporter in Detroit was the one who debunked the New York Times' framing, where this reporter was actually there at the event and talked to people who were holding up auto workers for Trump, union members for Trump. And it turned out that people holding up these signs almost to a person were not either union members or auto workers. And so that kind of exposed the sleight of hand and deception that was going on there. And that was via a local reporter, you know, who doesn't have the platform that the New York Times does or the Washington Post has. And so, yeah, I mean, those are important differences. Obviously, you know, there's a whole other conversation about how local media has really been, you know, kind of emaciated, and there's not, you know, there aren't as many local reporters operating these days as there were even, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And so we have to rely upon, you know, more national, you know, economies of scale that outlets like the Times or Post has, or, you know, people on social media who may or may not be credible. You know, that's important too, to be able to discern credible information from information that is not as credible. But, you know, I think you're absolutely right with your suggestion or claim that there should be more attention paid in coverage to how policies affect people and, you know, where the rubber meets the road in terms of communities and how policies affect communities and people and less on the horse race. But, you know, if you're someone like a Peter Baker at the New York Times, I mean, you're trained as a political journalist. And so that's, you know, I wouldn't expect him to kind of make a 180, you know, 20 years into his career and cover these stories in a way differently than he ever has. I think it's more of a question of who can fill in those gaps, you know, and there's not a lot of bandwidth with local outlets to do that these days. And so it's a difficult situation, and I don't have answers for what the solution is other than trying to hold some of these outlets accountable. And in my own work, you know, try to do a better job bringing out how these policies affect people. But I certainly wouldn't expect to see that, like I said, on Fox News or Fox Business. So, you know, but the policies broadly, you know, the policies broadly are the same. I mean, Glenn Youngkin's policies are basically Ron DeSantis's policies. And so, yeah, I mean, it's important to highlight that for sure.
So one more question about more national, and then I want to talk about independent journalism like yours and others. On the national front, do you feel that the press is doing a good job showing the general approach to whether we ought to be a democracy. I mean, the fundamental what is America question and who are Americans, when there was that Project 2025 saying, well, you know, when Trump is elected, we're going to eliminate the national bureaucracy and essentially turn into an autocracy, or mm-hmm. legislative Republicans who are supportive of Trump, supportive of January 6th, and also can't get their act together. Do you feel like the national political journalism is mm-hmm. really talking about those kind of stakes in a way that is helpful for the readers, or would you want to see that done differently if mm-hmm. it were up to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly there are big problems in that area. I mean, one that comes to mind right away is, you know, I pay really close attention to Manu Raju at CNN. He's their congressional reporter, you know, because he breaks a lot of news. He's constantly talking mm-hmm. to members and right. has little video interviews, and so they can make for good clips that I post and that sort of thing. But like, he's constantly talking these days to Marjorie Taylor Greene and kind of treating her as a serious power broker, which she is within the Republican caucus. But, you know, if we were in a sane democracy, I mean, this would not be a person that you would be turning to for political insights or really putting much emphasis on what her positions are. So when you treat politics kind of like a horse race, or you're very focused on the process of like how a speaker is selected, things like that, I mean, you end up normalizing a lot of really bad actors. I mean, another guy, Tim Burchett, who's a congressman from Tennessee, he's on CNN constantly, like, you know, almost every day. He's a Freedom Caucus guy, about as far right as they come. But, you know, he presents well on TV. He's polite. And, you know, when he goes on CNN, they don't really ask him about his policy positions. It's all about who you're going to support for speaker. You know, Matt Gaetz kind of, you know, like Matt Gaetz, I mean, the whole reason that he ousted McCarthy was because he knew that it would bring a lot of attention upon him and generate a lot of TV hits and things like that. And it has. You know, he's on CNN. He's on the Sunday shows. He was mm-hmm. on CBS, NBC. So, you know, so yeah, I mean, I think that if we were really covering politics in a way that framed the stakes appropriately, you wouldn't even talk to someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz, these people who are proven liars and, you know, are very, they're concerned about kind of themselves first and foremost, and, you know, policy or how that's affecting their constituents kind of comes second, if at all. I mean, and I think that's a problem that we see with the Republican Party very broadly these days, is that there's really been a disconnect between, there's no accountability. Like, there, like a person like Matt Gaetz is in such a safely red district that there's almost nothing that he could do or say that would endanger his seat. And so that basic mechanism of democratic accountability, the sense that if you're not pursuing policies or doing things in Washington that are benefiting your constituents or helping them, that they're going to throw you out of office, like that seems to be kind of broken down in a lot of these very red seats. One of the exceptions being like a Lauren Boebert, who, you know, won by, I think it came down to like 100, 200 votes last time. Like, she's very much at risk of mm-hmm. losing her seat. But, you know, someone like a Matt Gaetz or Marjorie Taylor Greene, or a lot of these members of Congress, Freedom Caucus people who are from Southern districts, like they don't have to worry about that. And, you know, the only thing they really have to be worried about is the possibility that they'd be primaried. But if they were primaried, it'd be by someone who's even further right than them, because that's kind of how Republican primaries operate mm-hmm. these days. So, yeah, I mean, it is frustrating. You know, we're living through, as you and I talk, I mean, right now, you know, all of the drama in Congress, at least, surrounds who the next speaker is going to be. And so it gets treated as kind of this horse race story where, you know, these Republicans go on TV or they talk to TV reporters or, you know, New York Times reporters, Washington Post reporters, and all the questions are kind of about, you know, almost like it's some sort of, you know, like popularity contest. Who are you supporting for speaker? Why are you supporting them? That sort of thing. And the fact that these are pretty reprehensible politicians who embrace a lot of very harmful policies gets kind of pushed in the background and not even really mentioned. And so, you know, I think that's unfortunate, but, you know, that's kind of the press that we're working with these days. And I understand why they do it, because, you know, it does mm-hmm. matter who the speaker is to a point. And, you know, how that process unfolds is interesting. And, you know, people want to know what's going on. But, you know, if we were really, you know, as you kind of frame this whole discussion, we've come back to this a couple times now, but this emphasis on the stakes instead of the horse race, you know, I do think that would be a better way to conduct journalism from the standpoint of encouraging a healthy civic society. And that's not a consideration that's first and foremost. And so for a lot of the reporters who are actually talking to these people every day, it sort of falls to people like me and you, or, you know, other outlets that are doing things that are a little more non-traditional, to talk about that part, you know, maybe the most important aspects of the stories in a way that the mainstream press misses.
I think you're right. So I would love to hear more about the way that you're doing it. I follow you on X, Twitter. In fact, I followed all of your live tweets, so I didn't actually have to watch the debates, but I follow Public Notice. I also follow Judd Legum's Public Information, as many independent journalists as I can. Can you tell me a little bit more about what made you decide to start Public Notice and how that's going as an independent journalistic endeavor?
Sure. Well, yeah, and this is kind of interesting because it touches upon some of the stuff that we've talked about. But, you know, so I was at Vox previously, and my beat there was basically covering the Trump White House. I started there in late 2018. I was already covering Trump for Think Progress. And so that kind of brought me onto the radar of Vox, got me a job there. And I really enjoyed that. But then after the 2020 election, there was a ton of turnover there. Ezra Klein left, who was one of the founders. Matt Iglesias left. The two editors who were most directly involved in hiring me left. So there was massive turnover. And they brought in new people who, you know, I think were very well intentioned. But like, I remember one of the things that really, you know, so that happened. Then January 6th happened, like shortly thereafter. And so I was still covering Trump because he was still president. He was obviously, you know, on his way out. But there was, I remember after January 6th, there was an edict from the editors there to no longer basically directly quote Trump in stories or to post video, which I understand what because the idea was that, you know, he's using his words in these press appearances to incite violence, basically. And so we have to be really mindful of not playing into that. People who are reading me are not Trump supporters. Like, they want to know what's going on. They're not, right, you know, if I'm quoting him, they're not, you know, going to go storm the Capitol. I mean, that's just not my audience. But, you know, it kind of put this weird constraint on my coverage where, you know, I kind of worked around it, but I couldn't use video clips, which was kind of, you know, something that I have done for years and years. But it just became clear, you know, with kind of new management there that I was going to be more comfortable doing my own thing. I had a large audience on social media, which made it possible for me to go independent. You know, there's a lot of really talented journalists doing great work who just don't have mm-hmm. the scale of an audience that I have. And so, you know, if on social media you have 20,000 followers and they love your work, it's still not really, you know, the economies of scale just doesn't really make sense to start your own publication because you're not going to have enough subscribers for it to financially make sense. But when, you know, you have many hundreds of thousands of followers, it's kind of a different calculation. So, you know, at first when I went independent in the fall of 2021, I was writing every single newsletter. I was doing 4 a week. And I was doing kind of blog style coverage, which was really an extension of what I was already doing at Vox, really focused on the Republican Party, but, you know, kind of covering American politics more broadly. And then in May of last year, my son was born. And so, you know, having two little kids at home, I sort of transitioned more to a publisher role where, you know, I'm still writing a newsletter or two newsletters a week, but I also have a group of contributors who do fantastic work, who I edit and publish. And so it took me a while, but I've kind of now found kind of a nice work-life balance with it, or at least a better one, where when I was writing four of them a week, part of the problem was that I was so immersed in writing that it almost became hard to track news. And, you know, it's been a really good career move for me. It's been 2 years now. I just hit 2 years last week, and it's going beyond my wildest dreams. And I think I'm up near about 70,000 total subscribers. And so, you know, I've tapped wow. into a good audience, kind of building off what I already had on social media. And I had, you know, kind of a sense for mm-hmm. what stories were going to resonate with my audience, like the type of coverage we had to do. You know, like, for instance, this past Monday, I knew that I had to have something on the attack on Israel and kind of the conflict in Gaza. And so I was able to get one of the contributors, Noah Berlatsky, who I work with, doing a piece kind of on yes. the American reactions to it. And so, you know, that's part right. of what I do, is not just making sure that the newsletter is good, but making sure that we are covering topics that are of interest to readers and making sure we have a story mix that, you know, it's a very small group that I work with, so we can't cover everything. It's not like the New York Times or the Washington Post, but like, I want to make sure that we have some coverage of the big stories so that, you know, people who rely upon the newsletter as part of their news mix are informed about the big stories that are going on.
Well, I want to commend you. The people who are contributing really are fantastic. I've seen some of the best coverage of certain issues on your newsletter than I've seen anywhere. And so you've done a great job getting a group together that is doing that. What do you see as the future in a much larger sense of independent journalism? How is that going to work? Is a new force to be understood and reckoned with in the public sphere?
Good question. I mean, I think we've kind of hit peak newsletter, it feels like, where, you know, it was like everybody was leaving their jobs to start a newsletter, you know, 18 months ago. And it seems like that's kind of cooled off a little bit. I think we're really in a time of like major flux right now, you know, with Twitter basically dying or, you know, being ruined. That really kind of makes it, you know, it feels like people are sort of trying to figure out what's next, you know, myself included. Right. But, you know, these are decisions that we're having to grapple with that, you know, 2 years ago, no one was thinking about like, oh, I need to get off Twitter. If you were, it was because like you were addicted to it, or, you know, it wasn't because of policies on the platform necessarily. And so that really hurts independent journalism, because Twitter was kind of as close as we had to sort of like a public square. One of the first episodes that happened when I got on Twitter was the killing of Bin Laden. And I don't know if you remember that, but there was a man who was in, I believe it was Abbottabad in Pakistan, where Bin Laden was hiding out. And there was a person who could speak English who was in the town who, you know, posted photos of the raid, essentially, like a helicopter and smoke. And that was one of the, you know, that eyewitness account kind of circulated globally very quickly as news trickled out that this raid had occurred. That was like one of the first days that I was on Twitter. And so right away it was like, wow, this is a really powerful tool for that sort of citizen journalism, eyewitness accounts in places that there aren't necessarily reporters on the ground. You know, even before then, of course, there was the Arab Spring, you know, protests in the Middle East that people had documented on Twitter. And, you know, that's kind of like a, you know, it's sort of a through line from that to people doing newsletters and kind of doing their own thing, tapping into audiences directly without kind of the middle person of a publication needing to have a job be hired to write. You could write directly to an audience. And that's not going to go away. But I think the decline of Twitter has kind of made that more difficult for now. So, you know, I don't think independent journalism obviously is going away. I think that it's in a kind of a state of flux right now, where the newsletter model that people like myself use to write to an audience, you know, for me, it's going strong, but I think I'm not seeing as many people taking that plunge into doing it as I did a couple of years ago. So we're in a very transitional moment right now, I think.
I think that's true. And also for the reader, $5 a month for every newsletter gets expensive very quickly. And I've had to go through and try to realign how many I pay, you know, for sheer economic reasons. And I think you're right about the Twitter situation and Thread situation. And frankly, internationally, Twitter is still the place where citizens go to tell their stories. And so I've seen this in the last week. My PhD is in Middle Eastern studies, and so I'm very, very closely focused on Israel and Palestine, and that's where the most interesting coverage is. Threads in the last week has gotten almost as bad as Twitter in terms of the amount of vitriol that I have seen. And I feel like on Twitter, I have the ability to really focus who I'm paying attention to much better than I do on Threads, because it's just not a way to do it. The international community hasn't made that leap yet.
I was just going to say, like in the EU, you can't even be on Threads. So I get that a lot when I post on Twitter, like find me here on Threads. I'll get people who are in Europe saying, well, we can't even be on Threads. It's a tough time in the world, but you just have to be very careful about what you say, you know, unless you're aiming for those sorts of antagonistic interactions, which I'm not.
I'm mindful of the time. So I just want to ask you where you think your newsletter is going in the future.
Well, you know, I mean, I've really only processed it as far as like this coming presidential cycle. I try to cover Trump from the standpoint of the stakes and kind of what he represents and the threat of Trumpism. And so, you know, that's been my beat really going back to 2016 at this point. You know, obviously I was devastated when he won the first time around in 2016. And I was an editor at the time at Think Progress. And so I was kind of looking forward to resuming more of those roles and kind of, you know, my background is in philosophy. I have a master's degree in philosophy, and my undergrad studies were in poli-sci. So I've always felt kind of like well-equipped to talk about Trumpism from the standpoint of authoritarianism and kind of threats to democracy, maybe more so than other political journalists are. So that's kind of, you know, that's really as far as I can kind of foresee things. I mean, I was on honestly just kind of reflecting last night that like, if he does win again, which I think it's unlikely, it's not like a 0% chance, but you know, I think there's maybe like a 20-30% chance that he wins. It would honestly be kind of hard to keep doing this, because, you know, at a certain point, it's like, what are we talking about here? I mean, you know, if he's reelected after everything that we've gone through, after, you know, the exposure that this guy has gotten and, you know, kind of exposed as being a con man and a fraud, and then he gets elected again. So, you know, I'm going to obviously keep covering this campaign and, you know, doing the type of work that I have been doing for the next 13 months. And then we'll kind of see from there. I mean, you know, I feel very grateful and privileged to have the audience that I do and to be able to do the type of work that I do, which is obviously, it can be quite demanding and stressful. But, you know, on the other hand, these are very historic times, and it's important to, you know, it's important to cover them journalistically and to make sure that the stakes of what's going on is framed appropriately. But we'll see. For myself, being a progressive journalist who covers Trumpism primarily, I can really only plan out toward, you know, the November 2024 at this point, and then kind of all bets are off, because hopefully people make the only sane choice and do not reelect this guy, which, again, I don't think is going to happen. But I think there is a lot of frustration with Biden, which I think mostly is unfair, because, you know, we have to remember that in January 2021, just how dire things were. And this notion that Biden is responsible for inflation, sure, some of his policies did contribute to inflation, but I think that pumping money into the economy, given where we were at in January 2021, was perhaps an optimal approach. I mean, the job market is very strong. Inflation hurts people, and we shouldn't hand wave that. But I think given where we were in January 2021 to where we are now, the economic stewardship has been solid, and he's done a good job protecting our democracy. So I'm going to keep running through the tape here until next election cycle, and then, you know, we'll kind of see what the world looks like. Hopefully I'll be able to cover slightly happier things at that point.
Well, I really hope so. And I do count on your newsletter. I reposted one of the articles about Trump supporters that I thought was the most cogent analysis of the people supporting Trump that I had ever read, which is a lot, because I read a lot of them. So I think you're doing a great job, and I'm glad that you're there and doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
And I thank you for coming on.
Thank you for listening to Freedom Over Fascism. Kudos to our editor, Benji Wilson. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and please drop us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts.